From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Humankind has always had a way of keeping the flock in line. It's called shaming. But we've also brought shamers into line. Judge not, lest ye be judged, says the Bible. With the coming of the internet, shaming is now on steroids. People in the millions anonymously can go on the attack on Facebook or Twitter or Reddit in an avalanche of posts, go after one person for one trespass, or what the cyber mob thinks is a trespass, with tough consequences. This hour on Point, internet shaming, and when it works, when it goes too far, too fast. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you know the easy thrill of internet shaming? Have you done it? Gone after someone you'd never met online? Have you been a target? Is it righteous fury or is it mob rule? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is Kate Klonick. She's an attorney, legal scholar, resident fellow at the Information Society Project at Yale Law School. Has done a lot of work on cyber shaming. Kate Klonick, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Also with us from New York is Jesse Singel, senior editor at nymag.com, New York Magazine's online publication. He edits and writes for the Science of Us blog at New York Magazine. It's about human behavior and psychology and has written thoughtfully about the psychology around online behavior. Jesse Singel, great to have you with us as well.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Jesse, just remind us of a little bit of the cascade of internet shaming incidents that we have seen just in the last handful of years.
Yeah, there's one story that really leaps out at me, probably because it was one I reported on about 9 months ago. It's a really good example of how this stuff works in practice. So back in August or September, a college student named Monica Foy, who was not a public figure, she had about 20 Twitter followers. A sheriff's deputy had just been tragically shot and killed outside Houston pumping gas. She had a tweet that was sort of a failed joke or bit of political commentary about the culture of victim blaming when young black men get shot. Usually, in any other case, nobody would have seen this tweet. Only her 20 followers, that would have been it. This popular but sort of gonzo far-right website called Breitbart discovered she had tweeted this.
What did she tweet?
She basically made a joke about sort of what did this cop do to deserve it. He must have had pervy eyes or something. It was, you know, it was a really offensive joke about someone who had just been murdered.
But it was meant to be tongue-in-cheek or a send-up.
Yeah, exactly. In the same way, you know, Trayvon Martin must have been a thug. Michael Brown must have been a thug. That sort of thing. So this far-right website Breitbart finds out she tweeted this, and they do a whole short article dedicated to the fact that this random 26-year-old college student tweeted something they found offensive. And they linked to her social media accounts. They mentioned her by name. I believe they mentioned, you know, where she went to school. And pretty quickly, this had been blasted out to their millions of social media followers. And the inevitable result was an avalanche of harassment and death threats. She actually got driven from her home because so many people were calling, threatening to rape or kill her.
And this is somebody who had 20 Twitter followers. So she was not exactly a social media maven.
Exactly, yeah. And that's part of, I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about it, but that's part of the disturbing trend here is the weaponization of online shaming and harassment. You don't need to have a platform anymore to be victimized by it.
Kate Klonick, it can go so big so fast now. Millions of people can pile on, and we've seen instances where that's exactly what happens. I want to look at some of those and how they unfolded, but get us in touch with what this is piece of when it comes to human psychology. I mean, the act of shaming, there's nothing new about it. It's more the access to major scale shaming that we've got here.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that in, you know, the days where you would put people in the stocks or there would be some type of public consensus around shaming or shaming was used as a punishment that we kind of look back at as archaic. In those days, at the very least, shaming was conscribed by geography. You had to, if you were going to shame someone else, you had to walk to the public square and do it. You had to put your own reputation at stake. And it took time and you had to go and shame someone at the cost of, you know, doing something else, like going to your job. And today, the internet just makes all of those natural limits completely disappear. You know, people in Mississippi shame people in Afghanistan. People in India shame people in Alaska. There's just the community is so much larger the shaming can be anonymous, and it takes absolutely no time, and just has and has little or no cost to the shamer.
So, is shaming something that I don't know? Would an anthropologist look at it, or a sociologist, and say this is useful, this is important, this is how humans police themselves from amoral behavior? So we're just doing it on a bigger scale.
I mean, I think that, yes, absolutely. I think that shaming is seen as a form of norm enforcement. I think that that would be anthropologically how people would refer to it, that we have social norms that we think they could be values or moral judgments that we think guide our community or should guide our community. And when people break those, you shame them to try to, you know, as just a very like non-judicious way of trying to enforce those norms. But I think that in a culture where that can be done so quickly and at such high volume and to such a wide audience, as Jesse said, it was weaponized. I think that's a great way of putting it. The internet does weaponize shaming. It just makes it so much more dangerous than it ever was before.
I mean, Jesse, some people say lynch mob when they look at this, but there are times when millions of people probably feel righteously correct in their online anger. I mean, when you had this dentist who shot Cecil the Lion, the internet, social media went berserk over that, but I don't know anybody who really felt bad about going berserk. When you get into the case of the so-called gorilla mom whose son got into the gorilla cage or enclosure there, maybe people were angry at first, but then they softened up and felt more humane. And then you can go to stories like perhaps like yours about the college student hounded out, and maybe others will hear in this hour, where it turns out that people feel almost embarrassed that they were so ready to pile on and shame. So maybe there's nothing we can say blanket about this. Is it okay sometimes and not others? Or do you see it somehow as always dangerous, bad?
I think it's always dangerous. I think you could, you know, rattle off the most extreme situation imaginable about, you know, a neo-Nazi reading Mein Kampf out loud proudly, and I'd say I wouldn't want an online shaming there because there are always collateral consequences. Their families always get sucked into it. It never – being the victim of a shaming very rarely sort of has some sort of positive effect on the world. You don't turn the Nazi into a thoughtful, compassionate person.
Well, maybe dentists in Minneapolis will be less likely to go and kill the last great lions of Africa.
Well, but even in that case, it's much more complicated than it was reported. That was – my understanding is that was part of sort of an auction that where you shoot one lion and the funds are used to sort of protect other lions and to raise money for the park. These cases are always more complicated than good and evil is part of the problem, or almost always more complicated.
And yet, Kate, for a lot of people, it appears irresistible. I mean, Gorilla Mom, what? There was something like 500,000 people signed on this petition to have charges brought against her. I don't know how many more or less just went after her with really rugged comments online. There's something just viscerally irresistible for a lot of people about joining the shame parade.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredibly – I think that people are kind of to kind of reference kind of a psychology term, like system one or system two, that there's a very system one emotional response to these types of events, especially that's especially tapped into when animals are killed, I think. And then, you know, there's a system – what we call a system two response, which is kind of a more rational, thoughtful process. Legal systems are designed to bring us to a system two resolution. They're designed to make us thoughtful and contemplative and seek out procedural justice so that we have the full story, as Jesse said.
In the court system, that's the way.
Exactly, the court system. But I mean, what's fascinating to me is actually a lot of the cases recently. Like, so you have the Brock Turner incident where you have this huge outpouring of shaming after.
This is the Stanford rape case.
This is the Stanford rape case, exactly. And so even when there's what I think was fascinating there is you had charges brought against him, you had him found guilty, and people disagreed with the sentence. And whether that was right or wrong, there was Jesse speaks of collateral damage. His entire family was dragged into the battle, and I think that it just shows that there's even when you have the justice system as part of this, online shaming can happen despite that.
Jesse, it never sleeps, this appetite or this readiness to come down like an avalanche. I mean, it seems that at any moment in the 24 hours of any day, something can come up that becomes the trending outrage of the millisecond, and you'll get gazillions of people signing on to pounce and punch and punish.
Yeah, it's absolutely getting worse every day, and I agree with Kate that a big part of it is just the sheer frictionless of it. If everyone who wanted to shame somebody had to sit down and write a letter to them and send that letter, hardly anyone would do it. These days, anyone can just rattle off a quick tweet and join in the pylon. It's way too easy given human nature.
I mean, at one time, I guess the shaming also, as we suggested earlier, the threat of being shamed also applied to the shamer. If you went too far, people would look at you like, whoa, you're over the top. Online, maybe there's no such restraint.
No, especially because so much of it is anonymous. I mean, there's zero cost to, frankly, sending someone a death threat, as I'm sure we'll get into. Oftentimes, you can do that with impunity. So, you know, let alone calling someone a name or whatever.
I will say that Adria Richards is like a great example of someone who shamed someone and then received an incredible outpouring of shame against her and a backlash of shame against her. And it does happen occasionally. And I think a lot of people would think that was undeserved on Richards' part, but it does happen. But when it's anonymous, you're right, Tom, that it's very difficult to kind of have any type of repercussions for the shamer.
Adria Richards, remind us of that case.
Yeah, that was the case where a woman who was in tech was at a conference and she shamed a group of people in front of her for making sexist comments, and they were fired from their jobs, and because of that, she was shamed in turn by the mob.
The mob can turn in a lot of directions in
big
hurry. Kate Klonick, please stand by there with the Information Society Project at Yale Law School. Jesse Singel with nymag.com. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about internet shaming, cyber mobs, the way an online firestorm can now take down an individual in an hour, can crush Gorilla Mom or make a villain out of a nobody overnight, how that works and what it says about the technology and about us. Kate Klonick is with us. She's an attorney, legal scholar, resident fellow at the Information Society Project at Yale Law School with us today from New York. Jesse Singel is with us, senior editor at nymag.com, New York Magazine's online publication. And you can join us this hour. Do you join in the mob when this gets going? What's the purpose exactly? Is it to make the world right? Is it to grab a pound of flesh? Is it an urge to justice or blood lust? Do you see mobs leaping to conclusions, ready to destroy someone on a sliver of information, maybe false information? Have you been the target, the victim of an online mob? Larry's calling from Boynton Beach, Florida. Hi, Larry. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I think this is a great discussion and one that's been pretty much long overdue. But I think there's a dynamic here that has been touched on that I think we kind of maybe need to emphasize a little bit more.
Okay.
That the sort of the social media, the combination of narcissism and anonymity tends to create this sort of perfect storm of entitlement and impunity, that when there's nobody checking, and the point that came up before one of your guests, I think used the word earlier, frictionless, which I think is a very, very appropriate. When there's no friction, when there's nobody checking, when there's nobody looking, people, especially in social media, tend to kind of give their worst. And I think this power behind the anonymity and the sort of entitlement, the narcissism, the sense that what they think, their opinion, has to be put out there, being overly critical as a way of feeling self-justified.
Yep.
I think these are a lot of the underlying dynamics that are behind cyber bullying, cyber shaming, which I think are kind of one and the same thing, just different degrees.
I'm glad you put it just that way, Larry, and let us pick it up. I appreciate your call from Florida. Jesse, what about, in particular, the anonymity we get, though it's not perfect anonymity. I mean, a lot of people are identifiable on Twitter and still let loose, you know, all barrels blazing. But the narcissism factor here, do you agree, Jesse? What's going on with that?
I think it's sort of case by case. I think sort of in the heat of the moment, participating in an online shaming mob maybe different people have different motivations. For someone who's anonymous, it's hard for me to get exactly how narcissism fits in, maybe, because they're not really, you know, presenting a recognizable view of themselves that where other people can see who they are.
Well, but you could just be self-satisfied in your scathing criticism, I suppose.
I do. Yeah, that's true. And I think especially the whole system one thing of people really relying on emotions and being emotionally enraged, it causes a lot of that sense of I'm going to right this injustice.
Kate, narcissism and anonymity as fuel for the fire.
Yeah, I actually don't think it has as much to do with narcissism. I think that we have now online communities and how people express themselves, what they would have talked about while they were sitting with a bunch of their friends at a diner having coffee. Mm-hmm. Now they just do on Twitter. I don't think that it's necessarily about narcissism. I think people always thought well of themselves and their opinions. It just they didn't have the loudspeaker to kind of put it out there.
But the ferocity of a lot of this criticism online, not to mention the vulgarity, the profanity, and the menace that's often in it, or the outright threats of death or rape or you name it. I mean, the stuff can flow awfully fast and furious, Kate.
Yeah, I think that this is actually fascinating because I think that it's so quick to move. And so we're talking about online shaming and cyber mobs. But I think some of the things that Jesse was alluding to a second ago about rape threats and death threats and things like that, that tips directly into something different. I think that tips into cyber harassment and things that we can actually find punishments for in the law. And I think that it's very difficult when something is just, you know, you're telling someone what a jerk they are online versus you're sending them rape threats or doxing them by releasing their private information, that there are things that people do specifically that actually that cross this line from shame, from just shaming into harassment.
Let's go to Tracy in Beverly, Massachusetts. Tracy, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. I think the media contributes to this problem, and particularly the broadcast media. I can't tell you how many times.
That would be me.
No, I was very visual broadcast.
Okay. Okay. Oh, sigh.
No, that's okay. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've seen a news story where, you know, there's a graphic behind the anchor, and they're talking about, you know, this person on Twitter said this, and this person on Facebook said that, and I think that's just lazy journalism. You know, I want news stories that are produced by people who went to journalism school and know how to discriminate. I mean, if I want an opinion about an issue, I'll just walk down the driveway and ask my neighbor, you know? I mean, and I think that that encourages these people who are already narcissistic because it makes them think that their opinions are, you know, that important.
Tracy, it's interesting. Let me take it to you, Jesse, if I may. I mean, news media might not have gone out and say, hey, I heard down at the diner X, Y, or Z. But frequently now, news media will quote something off Facebook or off Twitter or you name it and bring it right into the news story. It's a little bit of gasoline on the fire.
Yeah. excuse me. This actually happened a couple weeks ago. There was a the horrible alligator case. Someone tweeted something really insensitive and dumb about that.
Where the family lost their 2-year-old at the Disney Resort in Florida, and it was kind of like the gorilla mom pylon. Like, why weren't they watching out for this kid?
Yeah, but then there was a tweet to that effect, basically criticizing the parents and it was, or the dad, and it was phrased in a really provocative way. Mm-hmm. So then there's suddenly a whole spate of news stories, including in major outlets like Wired, just pointing to the existence of the tweet and the fact that people are outraged about it. So we're at a point where outrage has become a story worth telling in itself, and inevitably that sort of coverage just has a cascade effect and a snowball effect.
I want to look into one of these cases in particular, and you may remember the story about – it was all over the news. The headlines were Aunt Sue's nephew, and people went crazy about it. Here's just a little bit of the news reporting that came out about the story of Jennifer Connell.
Well, it's a lawsuit that's all in the family.
Oh, listen to this.
The family relative suing a boy over an accident at his birthday party when he turned 8.
She says he broke her wrist, caused her pain and mental anguish.
She claimed that her little nephew gave her a, quote, forceful hug.
She is disgusting and vile. I hope someone breaks her other wrist and maybe her legs as well.
She's suing the now 12-year-old boy for $127,000.
That's right, $127,000 over a hug.
A montage there from the New York Times documentary The Outrage Machine. That was about Jennifer Connell, who had been at a birthday party. Her arm was broken by a young child, a nephew as it were, and to make her insurance claim, she ultimately had to sue. There's no other way to do it, and it turned into quite a firestorm. Jennifer Connell joins us right now from New York. Jennifer, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Remind us what happened after those reports characterized your interaction there at the birthday party.
I became globally hated. The news spread fast and furious all around the globe, it seemed. And beside having reporters at my door and at Sean's door for days, the whole matter just spun wildly out of control on the internet.
What were the consequences for you, Jennifer? I mean, a few nasty tweets online doesn't seem like such a big deal.
Well, I guess that wouldn't be a big deal, but this was far more than a few nasty tweets. I can't even imagine how many comments there were. I also was the recipient of some mail. Somehow my actual address was released, so I did receive mail. In fact, there's apparently a company called Send Your Enemies Glitter, and someone paid to send me a glitter bomb to my home, telling me what a horrible person I am.
I mean, online you had people saying, asking if you're the most despicable human on the planet, what an evil witch, are you saying, Jennifer Connelly, you're wasting precious oxygen. Did it have real-world consequences for you, that mountain of attack, Jennifer?
Well, in my opinion, my reputation was, you know, certainly dragged through the mud and sullied, and I'm in a profession that is very reliant on professional reputation and connecting with professionals in my industry, and that was definitely impacted. I mean, I certainly had friends say to me, you know, we all know that before we hire someone, we Google them. I mean, this, I think, is very common now in this era, that we Google one another and people we meet and people we may want to hire to learn about them. So I would say, yes, it was.
And what was it that they were all missing? We heard that flood of news headlines from big, well-known news outlets. What were they missing in your story? I mean, when you say, you know, Auntie Sue's nephew for broken arm, it's easy to feel like, what the heck? Remind us exactly what they were missing.
Well, I think what they were missing was doing any research of their own. There was one small piece written by a local reporter who actually wasn't even present at the proceeding, and it was just picked up widely. And I don't believe that any other news organization followed up. That's my impression. I could be wrong, but I don't believe any other news organizations followed up. They just, you know, shared repeatedly this one small piece that was completely sensationalized, very skewed and biased.
And here is Jennifer Connell. She ended up on NBC's Today Show with her young nephew, Sean.
This was simply a formality with an insurance claim.
I felt like everybody was saying stuff that they didn't know.
And a lot was said. Kate Klinik, what can we learn from Jennifer Connell's story when it comes to internet shaming?
Yeah, Jennifer, I'm so sorry. This is such a horrible story, and I unfortunately have heard so many stories like this at this point. But yeah, I think that also what happens in Jennifer's case, which I think is makes this especially egregious, is how wrong everyone got it. And this is, I think, that one of the scariest parts of online shaming is when people react and people pass along this judgment and this shame, and they think that it's in the name of some type of justice or some type of enforcement of societal enforcement of some type of norm, and actually they're completely incorrect. And so it's the reason we don't have mob rule to begin with, and why we have like our system of laws and court systems. So it's really unfortunate.
Take a call here. Brenda in Aiken, South Carolina. Brenda, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I agree with about 95% of what I'm hearing, but sometimes the shaming is deserved. I am really outraged that one of your guests has tried to justify the killing of Cecil the Lion and other magnificent animals by saying that it was about conserving the other animals. That is not true. Those safari companies operate for profit. They're not charities. If they were interested in conserving these animals, they could just ask their would-be hunters to give the money directly to that cause.
So you say, and if there's an online outrage, bring it on.
In some cases, and that certainly is one, if that dentist were interested in saving the animals, he could have given his $250,000 or $500,000, whatever he paid to kill that precious animal. He could have given it directly to the conserving efforts. And I have tracked this, and I have yet to see that any of these safari companies that claim to give to saving the animals have actually done so. But if they do, it's like $5,000 or $10,000 compared to the quarter or half a million they charge to kill one.
Brenda, we've got it. Kate Klonick, I mean, this brings us to a different angle on internet shaming. And maybe sometimes there's the wisdom of crowds at work here. Maybe people look at this and they're not buying the sort of fluff explanation for why this has to be. They see a moral outrage, if you will. Brenda would look at it that way, and they bring their numbers to bear on it, and who wants to be the next hunter in those shoes?
No, absolutely. So I think that Brenda's talking about even you know, I think that even if there was some type of there was a better way to give money to these conserving places, even if this was, like, let's imagine that this was completely deserved shaming, as I think Brenda believes, that I think that if you look at what happened to Walter Palmer, the dentist, it happened to his entire family. They had to leave Minneapolis. I mean, his children were taken out of school. There were huge ramifications, and it was completely out of control. So I'm not condoning, obviously, the killing of, you know, of wild animals necessarily, or like anything like that. And I think that if society thinks that those things aren't right, there are ways to do it. But shaming is just, it's so untethered from any type of control about when the punishment ends, how large the punishment becomes, that it just really becomes disproportionate to the crime. I think the problem that takes place with something like this.
Jennifer Connell, you were on the receiving end. What's your advice to people when they hear something in the media or they read it online and they want to jump in and fire away? What's your advice, perhaps, before they do that?
Well, I think it's very important to understand the context and do your research. If you want to respond to something, I think you should really be as informed as possible and also try to imagine what part of the story might be missing, because that may be the most crucial piece, is what you're not hearing.
Are you still feeling the effects of the hate that came down on you, Jennifer?
Well, in terms of, again, my professional identity and using my own name, Tom, yes, I am. I mean, I've had the experience where I've actually, you know, brought one of my nephews to a birthday party and have been almost ashamed to say my own name to the mom when I was dropping him off.
At a birthday party of all places. Jennifer Connell, we hope you we hope you escape that cloud, and we appreciate you spending a minute with us today.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Jesse.
Jennifer Connell, she was on the receiving end of a big cyber mob and maybe beginning to come out of it. We hope so. Kate Klonick, please stand by. Jesse Singel, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about internet shaming, cyber mobs, the way an online firestorm can now take down an individual in an hour or two, can crush Gorilla Mom, make a villain of a nobody overnight, looking at how that works and what it says about the technology and about us. Jesse Singel is here from nymag.com in New York. Kate Klonick is with us. She's with the Information Society Project at Yale Law School. You can join us as well. What do you see when these firestorms erupt online over things people have seen, things that have been done? Is this citizen justice of a kind? Is it mob rule? We were scared of the mobs in the past, the tarring and feathering, the lynch mob. Should we be scared of this? It's interesting. People, a lot of different angles on this. Write to on our website, Thinking Rights. People like to think they're better, smarter, more intelligent than everyone else. If they can find a person they can blast out their anger at, it makes them feel better about themselves, I guess. Hello Kitty says, I don't think this has much to do with narcissism. It's about self-righteousness and hubris. No one has humility anymore these days. No one has a sense of empathy or compassion. Well, there's some out there. But on the other hand, we also have here this comment, what if you actually do something shameful? And Neil writes, the rapist parents, talking about the Stanford case, were not drawn into it. Their written testimony was shameful. It's hard to decide when to pile on and when not. Susan in Brunswick, Maine. Susan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
So I had an interesting incident a couple of months ago. I was on the Facebook page of the PBS site and posted my opinion about a controversial opinion. There were a lot of opinions going around. Probably within an hour, I had over 100 posts that were in response to my post, which got more and more obnoxious. People calling me stupid, people calling me names, swearing at me.
Susan, what was the subject again? What had you written about that brought on this?
It was an issue of transgenderism.
Okay.
And I simply posted my opinion about it, thinking this is an open forum. Let's
right.
have a discussion.
Right.
Very, very interesting how so quickly there was just this, it was really palpable to me. Interesting, though, I did have one person private message me who was very kind, very reasonable, and said, I would really like to speak with you more about your opinion. These are my opinions. And we went back and forth a little bit. It was very interesting, and I really appreciated that, and I thanked him.
So the fury was not fun to feel, but after all that response, did you look at it and say, well, I learned something here? Did they have a point, even though it may not have been polite or kind or not?
I mean, I certainly appreciated the exchange in the sense of, differing opinions. I absolutely think that that's a really important thing for us to do. But it was the tone and I guess probably the, calling me names and calling me stupid and, you're only, like somebody actually went on my Facebook page and said, oh, I can see you're only this, in my profession, therefore taking me down according to them. That was, not a very remarkable thing for them, and so all the more reason for them to then attack me because I clearly couldn't have an opinion.
Susan, I appreciate your call. We now have a way to police and attack each other almost all the time, almost any time. Kate Klonick, Jesse Singel, please stand by. Jennifer Jacquet joins us right now. She's an assistant professor of environmental studies at New York University at the Stern School of Business. But she wrote a piece called Is Shame Necessary? New Uses for an Old Tool. Jennifer Jacquet, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You're ready to stand up and say there are times when this is useful. What can turn into a cyber mob has got some utility. Where, when and where?
Yeah, I mean, sure. So you have the case, I think the caller also mentioned it, about Cecil the Lion. So, of course, we know that the punishment was disproportionate. We know that this was largely carried out by an anonymous crowd. But I will say that Brenda made a good point against Jesse, which Jesse's point was sort of like what Walter Palmer did was legal. And so the idea that you would have this sort of crazy crowd response to it doesn't really make sense in that context. But just like with the bankers in 2008 and with Cecil, I think what you see is actually the crowd expressing sort of moral opprobrium even when the behavior is actually legal. And that is interesting, so that shaming has always served this function to sort of coalesce around new and old norms, standards of behavior in society. And so what I took from that case was this really interesting moment in American history where the crowd stood up and said, we actually don't really like this sport and what the sort of 1% of this country is able to do in Africa. And that was interesting. Now, we can get into whether or not, you know, the shaming was disproportionate, and I agree that it was. But my point is sometimes that it's not really the shaming per se that people have a problem with, but the intensity. And so we have to sort of untangle whether or not it's the form or, you know, the expression or whatever.
It can get intense very quickly, but you're pointing out there can be a kind of wisdom of crowds in here sometimes. Ryan in Beverly, Massachusetts. Ryan, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. Great topic of discussion, and I definitely agree that online shaming goes very far. But a few of my personal friends have kind of the logic or the understanding with them when they participate in something like that.
Yeah.
One recent conversation I had was about that, you know, that horrible incident for that college, the college girl that was, you know, raped behind the dumpster.
Stanford.
And he was only given 6 months. And a lot of times there's a mentality that comes out that, well, okay, our broken system has failed them. It's now up to us because we're the only ones left to provide any form of justice. Now, obviously, I think that goes too far sometimes, but I do think there is something to that understanding in certain situations.
I appreciate your call, Ryan. I mean, Jesse, how about it? Maybe this is an empowerment for a righteous moral sense in the public. I mean, you may not like the extent to which it goes. It can get ugly and profane and very threatening very quickly, but maybe this gives voice to an innate morality sometimes that wouldn't have had a venue or a way of applying its weight in earlier times.
No, I think I disagree with the idea that it can get crude or threatening or scary, because it always does. In every single case where there's an online shaming, it spins out of control. Families get pulled in. There's death threats. It becomes a nightmare.
So you're just saying shut up and sit down to a public who may not be happy with what they're seeing?
No, I'm expressing some hopelessness over the situations. I think this is only going to get worse, and there's probably nothing we can do about it. This idea that, oh, yeah, sometimes the crowd that's spawning death threats has the right idea. I mean, there's a lot of situations where, like, so the prison system, we need the prison system. That doesn't mean we're going to respond to mass incarceration by saying, oh, the prison system is the right idea. We should be able to recognize that some applications of punishment or norm enforcement are just inherently, the way we're doing them isn't working and they have collateral consequences.
Jennifer Jacquet, how about it? This is just inherently, this norm enforcement is inherently unacceptable, I guess.
Well, I think that if you look at across any form of punishment, capital punishment, prison, even the silent treatment, you'll find collateral damage. So I completely agree. Punishment is an ugly tool, no matter what it looks like. But I disagree with that every case is a nightmare. And one of them that stands out in my mind is the opportunity to call out members of Congress over Twitter who deny climate change. So this is something where there wasn't a major pile-on. No one received death threats, as far as I know. Congress didn't complain about it. It didn't also get amplified, you know, to the Today Show by any means. But it was used to signal that there was sort of widespread opprobrium for this kind of behavior in Congress. And so I don't see that every – I think the ones that we talk about tend to have the features that we've been focused on, this disproportionality, the nightmare scenario. But a lot of online shaming is actually completely proportional and goes below the radar, which is why we don't talk about it.
Kate, what about it? There's an avenue here for voiceless people that lets them weigh in with a kind of moral judgment. You know, it can sound good.
Yeah, so I actually have to disagree with Jennifer, because I think that there's the examples that she gives and the examples that she writes about in her book are about shaming corporations or shaming, as she just said, Congress people. Those are public figures. I think that those people put their opinions and their themselves out there to basically and are more capable of receiving that type of blame. But I don't think that the same thing is true of, you know, the Monica Foy story that Jesse talked about, like the college student with 20 Twitter followers who randomly gets picked out of obscurity and shamed. And I think that that, you know, Jennifer said that you think that it's often proportionate. But I think that it, to the person who's feeling the shame, it always feels disproportionate. It always feels like a giant wave of hate and judgment that's pouring over them from random likes and retweets and occasional death threats. Even if it doesn't escalate to death threats, just that judgment that the caller, Susan, talked about before, even in just a forum online, just feels incredibly overwhelming to what is often just voicing someone's opinion.
Lynn in Syracuse, New York. Lynn, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to add a little bit to the debate, too. We had a predator, a child predator here in one of our parks, and when he was finally caught and his name was released, there was a firestorm of problems for another young man the same age with the same name who lived here and had no relationship at all to what was happening. He was totally, his whole life was turned upside down just by the fact that he had the same name as a predator.
Yeah, so the tool, the weapon, the weaponized anger can hit the wrong person and hit it in a hurry. I mean, I don't know which way to go with this. Jennifer, here's a comment from Eric on air. He says, look, internet shaming is simply something that comes with the territory, and it should if we're going to maintain a free and open internet. He also says, it kind of suggests that no one's not a public figure these days. If you have 20 Twitter followers, you're on Twitter, and if you know, so you're connected to 20 million or I don't know how many billion at this point. I mean, should some people be exempted from this, or do we just have to accept that this is the way of the internet age? The vast numbers and their opinions, whatever they may be, are going to come down wherever they like. It's like the wind. You're not going to control it.
I'm sympathetic to this idea that there might not be any real fix for this. Like, I think actual death threats and threats of bodily harm, we need to do a better job with those. But a lot of internet shaming isn't that. So I agree with that comment in the sort of pragmatic sense that anyone who is online, especially under the real name, needs to understand that this could happen to them. And frankly, I'm not sure I would tell any of my friends who don't have Twitter or Facebook presences that, like, this is a good time to sign up and start expressing political opinions. We think of the internet as this free exchange of ideas, this sort of wonderland, but it gets pretty dark and can be scary. And I'm just not sure there's anything we can do about it.
Jennifer, how do you draw lines here? I mean, you're open to this being useful sometimes, but you can clearly see when it turns into the equivalent of a lynch mob. Is there anything to be done about that? Or is that just the new age? Kate, let me put that to you.
Yep. I think that it is part of the new age, but I do think that having conversations like this and discussing the downsides of online shaming and whether these are smart things to take part in and smart things to perpetuate ourselves, what might make more people think when they retweet something or press a like button that is making fun of or eviscerating a person online. And I think that that is like part of the idea of just changing norms and creating new norms that fight back against this type of enforcement tool of shaming.
How are we going to distinguish? Do you think that over time we'll develop some kind of self-control here, or does human nature, you know, that can get in a crowd and get pretty excited and really pile on? Is it just amplified by this technology in a way that Jesse says there may be no way out of the misapplications of this when they occur?
I think that there's always going to be misapplications, but I do think that we're already, at least in my Facebook feed, the outrage over the gorilla mom faded much quicker than the outrage over Cecil the Lion. I think the more these things cycle into the news and they happen, the more kind of de rigueur like the whole system is going to become. So maybe there's hope that this just people will, to a certain extent, recognize it and see what it for what it is and maybe start to disengage quicker. But I don't know that Jesse could be right. Maybe it's all just like what we get when we sign up for the internet.
Eric in Oklahoma City. Take us home, Eric. You're on the air.
Yes. I want to completely agree with what was just said. I do believe that is the nature of the internet, that the internet is to remain the open source of information and exchange of ideas. If you're going to join the conversation, you have to be prepared and have thicker than thin skin and not be so hypersensitive to the opinions of others, regardless of how extreme they may be.
Well, why exactly, Eric? I mean, before the internet, if we walked out in the street, you were in public, but you didn't have to assume that a mob would descend on you and beat the tar out of you. Why do we have to assume that on the in the internet that's just the way it is?
Well, it is what it is. It's a new form of communication. There's no set of rules, I think, or decorum that anyone will produce that will change that. If you walk into the town square and you pontificate or express yourself in a way that others don't like to hear, you probably can count on a mob descending upon you.
But a mob, death threats, and all the rest, do you think that's a permanent thing, or is that early days?
These things are regulated under the law, and we have things in place for that. But the expression of opinions, I just simply think the exception I would take was the young woman who suffered the backlash of shaming after she shamed the men who, I guess, eventually lost their jobs.
Yep.
To say that she's not a public person, but she only had 42 people on Twitter, well, when she got on Twitter, she became a public person. I think people need to start taking a little more responsibility for what happens on the internet and what they say.
Huh. Individually, maybe we can do that. When all those individuals get together, it can turn into a tidal wave. Sometimes it can wreck lives. Maybe it can also set a moral compass or two right. When you get those numbers going, you never know exactly how it's going to turn out. But maybe that is just the nature of the beast now that the technology is the web we live in. I want to thank my guests this hour, all three. Jennifer Jacquette in New York, thank you so much for being with us. Jesse Single at nymag.com. Jesse, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Kate Klonick with the Information Society Project at Yale Law School. Kate, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.